इतिहास द इंडियन हिस्ट्री पॉडकास्ट।
हाय एंड वेलकम बैक टू येट अनदर एपिसोड ऑन इतिहास पॉडकास्ट। I have earlier spoken on this podcast, we have had some conversations about how some food items, which we firmly believe were Indian or are Indian, actually came from outside. And they gelled so well with us and became Indian, so to say, that it's now sort of difficult to imagine them as outsiders. So some time ago, I discussed about chilies, I discussed about chai, the quintessential Indian chai, tea, how they were outsiders. And today, on this very new season, we are going to continue these conversations even further. And I have my very first guest with me to discuss the evolution of food with me. I and her go back long, long ago. Like, we studied together in our graduation days, and then she studied marketing. And from marketing, she completely switched to something totally different. She became a chef, a properly trained chef in New York. Then she did a stint at a Michelin star restaurant. And then she ran a very, very innovative restaurant in Pune in India. And now she is launching a food brand of her own. So please welcome Kirtida Phadke. Kirtida, welcome. It's lovely to have you on Itihas Podcast.
Thank you, Sneha. So excited to be doing this.
I mean, we keep on discussing this every now and then about our very interesting food history. And I'm so glad you're the first guest on this new season of Itihas. So we can sort of formally talk about this whole evolution of food, you know. We are going to discuss this topic in two episodes, one after the other. So in the very first episode, we'll go with the earlier theme of how outside food became Indian, how it came to India in the first place, and how we have adopted it, how we have localized it. So first thing would be to know why and how has all of this food landed in India. And first of all food is not Indian? I mean, let's at least hear the names of things which are not Indian. And then how they landed in India, through what ways?
You know, interestingly enough, we seem to be in a time where there's a lot of conversation world over about what is national, what is local, what is regional, whether it is in the food space in terms of trends that are being spoken of, or nutritionists asking you to eat local superfoods, or whether it is in a more political arena, which I will absolutely not go into.
That would be better.
Food is engaging, for me at least. If we start by defining Indian as pertaining to the geography that we post-independence know as India, and foods that are native or indigenous to this land, we would actually not know, it is very different from the Indian food as we have come to understand it today. You mentioned chilies, you've covered that in the podcast earlier. It's now pretty known that chilies, potato are not Indian in their origin. But let's talk about fruits, right? If you go to any regular fruit thela across India, you see a lot of fruits that we assume are local and Indian. For example, the papaya or sitafal, custard apple, or even pineapple. Like, would you believe it if I told you that none of these are Indian?
No, I absolutely wouldn't. Like, I have this feeling that my whole life has been a lie. You know what I mean?
It's been a delicious lie, because these fruits, they're not local to India. If we were to stick to fruits that were local to this land, we would pretty much just be eating bananas, mango, and jackfruit. Like, in terms of the more popularly known fruit, there were berries and strawberries and mulberries, but that were local to this land. Yeah. But what is interesting is things like papaya, of which India is the largest producer, as is the case with guava. Again, we're the number one producer globally. Pineapples. All these came to India fairly recently as part of something called the Columbine Exchange, which basically happened after Columbus discovered the Americas in 1492, so the late 1400s. There was an exchange of foods between the New World, which was the Americas, and the Old World, which doesn't mean just the West. It also means, well, the older food, known cultures. So India is included in that as well. So everything from potatoes, tomatoes, chili, tapioca, corn, peanuts, sweet potatoes, tobacco, all these fruits, these lovely fruits I mentioned, they're all part of that migration that happened to and from. We took these supposedly, well, foreign fruits and we made them Indian. We made them Indian in a sense that they are now widely available and grown in global numbers. We are the leading producer of fruits like papaya, guava, pineapple that we didn't even know about 500 years ago.
Right.
And so there is wide scale production because the land is suited to growing these. India has a great diverse landmass, you know, where you can pretty much find the soil to grow just about anything, whether it's fruits that come from these South Americas or it's something like a saffron that actually came from a Turkey or a Persia. You know, so there is that level of diversity. We have to grow these imports. What we do with them is also interesting. We make these foods that are not ours uniquely Indian in how we eat them.
Right.
In what we do with them. I spoke about like fruits that we cannot even imagine are not, well, local or native to our land. When I started, like, I've always been interested in what really is, you know, local food. Or as I mentioned, there's a lot of this almost has become a buzzword to say, you know, eat local. And there are several components to it. One component for sure is eating local helps the local communities, the farming communities, the right. ecosystem of growers around you that you should support. There is, when there's a certain value ascribed to local versus global, like I find it interesting that there's a lot of avocados are being hated upon in certain food communities as, oh my God, like why do you need to eat imported? But if you think of it, the history of chikus in India, yes, it's not as recent as avocados, but it's just about 200 years old.
I know what you're saying. It's interesting, you know, when you actually like how you started this, that what we know as the post-independence India, because most of us keep on having that as a sort of a reference framework. You know, we always think that India used to be what it is today. And that is not the case. So, for example, what you said about chikku, I'm honest here, till now, I did not know that chikku came from outside because it has gelled so well. And possibly 100 years later, avocado might also be. So these boundaries about whether they are the land boundaries or they are the food boundaries, they're very fluid.
Absolutely. It's constantly evolving, right? Because food, least of anything, is static because food moves with people, food moves with trade, and that's what I want to come to. I am not at all a historian or, you know, I'm not a researcher. So this is purely like my, like authors I have read to understand this better. Three main reasons for food exchange that has happened, say, till post-independence India. One of the foremost, I would say, is trade, because India has always, like since recorded history, India has been a part of major trade routes, maritime trade routes between South India particularly and the Roman Greco empires. The trade route between Indonesia and South India again. Or it was the Silk Route that, you know, India was a part of. So both maritime and land routes of trade were very important in creating the food, like some of the earliest known food exchange. The second influence, or rather the second factor that determined food coming in, was empires that colonized. One of the most known would be the Mughlai, because there's a whole cuisine named after it. But there is also the colonizers, in terms of the European colonizers, who have influenced our food. And the third would be, so the first we said was trade, because we've been part of trade routes. The second is empires that colonized us. And the third would be communities that settled in India.
Right.
So these are either, you know, to seek refuge or for trade. So these are people who moved and got their food along with them, and worked with what was available and what they had gotten in to create something uniquely different. Definitely in India, there's been so much movement for so long. It's impossible. We were not an isolated, secluded country that, you know, evolved independent of movement from outside. Flux and movement and incorporating things has been a very big part of how our food has evolved.
And all that is, Kirtina, let's say this is several hundred years ago, you know, what you mentioned, the Silk Route or communities that came from abroad and they settled in India, whether the Parsis or the Arab traders, etc. I want you to talk more about the modern day food exchange, where there's a very potent device that we have today where you don't need communities, and that is internet. We don't actually need physical interaction with any community whatsoever. As people started going abroad, as Indians started going, as more people from abroad started coming, and as in general information technology spread increased, we have a more modern sort of food exchange. So I want to know what you think about it.
So in the modern, internet-powered world, definitely I think internet has been, you know, there's been almost no need for physical interaction for influence, right? As you said, because of the internet, where you see something that is being made in a completely different land that you've not even visited, and you can replicate it in your own home basis. Well, information you glean from blogs or from influencers. The second thing that that's interesting that's been happening, at least in India post-liberalization, is international travel becoming more accessible to more people than ever before. Either it is to study or it is for leisure. The moment you travel outside, unless you are someone who is hell-bent on not exploring the food of the foreign land, coming across the food of the international location is almost unavoidable, right? Like you see right from the airport. I think in terms of modern adaptations, right, if we don't go back to, like, you know, the Columbine exchange or the Greeks and the Roman influencing our food, I think while talking to you, I was just thinking of, like, this one example that I came across that is now very common, the concept of a pav bhaji fondue. You know, you could see people dunking pav into a pot that contained bhaji, in a fondue pot that contained bhaji, using an international food concept that is very, French, to a very Bombay local street food. So you have that, you have avocados that we mentioned earlier, where you now have people growing avocados in India, consuming them the way they've seen the most common form is the guacamole, because, you know, you're making like Mexico has been a very big giver of wonderful foods to the world, whether it's tomatoes, chocolate, avocados, and in guacamole, I feel like so much of it comes together. You could have never traveled to Mexico, but you've seen it on maybe a MasterChef Australia, sitting in, and you're eating it with a papad instead of a tortilla, because that is what you have on hand. And that is how food is moving or being adapted to a quintessentially Indian form.
I also just did that. Like, day before, I made hummus because, you know, I had chole. I had spare chole and I wanted to cook something which was not chole. And then I didn't have pita bread or anything to go with it. So I just had a plain khakra and that tasted amazing. Think about it, Kitida. And this is not just about food. Whenever there is a foreign element in our life and when we want to adopt to it, you always have to fit that into a framework that you already understand. So for us, that having hummus with khakra is something on the similar line, because hummus may be foreign, but khakra is mine. I understand what is khakra. And that's why I localize that hummus in this way.
Absolutely. And that is what makes things Indian, right? Rather than the debate of, is it native to this land? When did it come in? I'm okay if it came in 1,000 years ago. But well, you know, if you're getting it in only 20 years ago, it doesn't fit my norms. This is actually a concept that isn't new. This whole stress on what the land grows, only eat of it. There was a movement. So India was exporting so much pepper that there was a similar movement happening in the West, where a small group of people, never too many, because people, like, they just love pepper, couldn't get enough of it. They were talking about how maybe we're not suited to eating this. So this debate has been going on. And I feel in India, we've done a fabulous job with localizing these imports and making them ours.
I think prime examples of that would be paneer pizza and possibly all Chinese that we get here. Everything Chinese.
Absolutely. In fact, I moved to Paris to study management when I was 22, and I met Chinese people for the first time then. And I made some Chinese friends, and I loved, you know, what is Indian Chinese. So Manchurian and Hakka noodles. Mm. And I told these friends, okay, let's make Chinese food. And they were absolutely shocked and scandalized at what I was proposing. They're like, what are these things? They're not Chinese. It's we've made it ours. You know, whether it's your Szechuan fried rice or Hakka noodles or chili paneer. Yeah. Which is interesting in itself, because paneer itself, whether how Indian it is questioned. One theory talks about how in the Vedic tradition, milk is so pious that curdling it is not seen as something good. Mm. So the very step needed to make paneer is something that some food historians ascribe to the Portuguese playing a role in giving us this curdled milk, because they were used to, well, you know, making like fresh cheeses by curdling milk. Mm. And that is actually the origin of paneer and chena, which is the base for all the world famous Bengali desserts.
Yeah.
But there's another theory that says it was also known in the Mughal kitchens. And the Mughal kitchens themselves were a confluence of Central Asian, which is where, you know, with Babur coming from Uzbekistan, Central Asian, Persian, and Northern Indian from that time. So,
yeah, so I agree. The chili paneer thing is, I mean, I never thought about it that way. It's, like I said, it's a revelation to me that paneer is also not ours. I'm telling you, my whole life has been a lie. I'm getting that feeling over and over. Talking about that localization part, Kirtida, I want you to speak about something that was really, really wonderful. So Kirtida she started a restaurant in Pune called Carlo. And that was a restaurant that was vegetarian. And till date, I'm honest here, I haven't been to a vegetarian only restaurant that offers so much of variety in terms of taste, in terms of texture, and in terms of the kind of influences that the particular food has. So Kirtida, I was really a big fan of the kind of menu that you put up there. So I want you to talk about your own experiences of localizing the global cuisine that you had been exposed to before. For example, your very famous Motichur cheesecake. And how did you think of doing something like this? And what were your thoughts behind localizing the global food?
Thank you, Sneha, for being so generous in your praise of Carlo and what we were trying to do at the restaurant. I feel like, you know, whatever you've been through, nothing ever truly leaves you. It's all, you carry it along. And that is how I approached the menu when we started designing it for Carlo. Mm. So, for example, if I were to take one dish that was always very doubtful when our servers recommended it to guests, but always got like second and third orders, was something we called eggplant roll-ups. So, I'll describe the dish first. So these are strips of the long, the bengan bharta, you know, sliced into thin strips, fried, cooled, and then lathered with some thick hunkar that's flavored with some garlic, chili powder, and crushed toasted walnuts. Mm. And mint leaves. And then it's rolled up. So these are roll-ups of these fried eggplant strips. And eggplant, again, isn't something that is... People don't want to go to a restaurant and eat bengan.
Yeah, that's the
last thing. Right? So they're like, yeah, no. And our servers were trained to like coax them into ordering it, saying, you know, if you don't like it, like we'll take it back. Because they knew that there wasn't a chance that was going to happen.
Yeah.
This is something I tasted in Paris. Mm. And I thought, let me, again, this is not a format Indians are used to having eggplant in. I felt like it could work for India, and it did. And again, eggplant is something that is local to India, apparently. That's like one of the vegetables that is indigenous to this land.
Good to hear that at least something that is not so
that we can eat. Yeah. So I'm trying to think of what else. So in our salads, we had something that we called mamemo, and again, it's a fun way to say it, and that's not the only reason it did very well. It was marinated two types of melons, and mozzarella with again like a very fresh lime dressing. Again, like the inspiration for this is the Greek feta salad. The inspiration was the Greek feta salad that I used to love. You know, chunky watermelon and salty feta. But feta was very difficult to procure locally. And I didn't want to work with imported products because I feel like one aspect is obviously the cost, but the second aspect is the fresher it is, the better it tastes. I mean, I'm not even going into nutrients, etc. And we found someone who made mozzarella locally. So yeah, so we said, okay, let's see if we can play around with that tartness of feta in the dressing, create our own tweak on the salad. Yeah, the Motizur cheesecake, you know, it was actually our really talented dessert chef. I had already defined the style that we were going in, globally inspired, but locally, like super relevant and locally procured. And the dessert menu had to reflect that. So Radhika actually came up with the Motichur cheesecake. It's a combination of two things Indians can't seem to get enough of, right? Cheesecake is globally liked, and Motichur is something that is so quintessentially Indian and associated with whether it's festivities or indulgence, that marrying the two just made it a surprisingly, actually not so surprisingly delicious offering.
Yeah, I think I've had everything on that menu, Kirtida, whether it's is that Ambe Dal Falafel, whether it's the Kathal ki Biryani, which was another one, I think, like this. Food, like everything else, is fluid. Like, it moves with time. It moves with places. It moves with people coming in, going out. So culture in general gets enhanced with the give and take, whether it's language, it's food, it's rituals. So this episode, we traced how the outside food was localized, how the import, so-called, was localized. And in the part two of this conversation, we are going to see how India exported some of its recipes, how some of the so-called Indian ingredients, some of the Indian food went abroad, and what has become of it today. That will happen in the next episode. So we'll stop here for the time being. Stay tuned.